You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Happy New Year and welcome to Snacky Tunes. Hope everyone had a nice break and an enjoyable holiday full of friends and food and good times. We're excited to be kicking off our 2023 season with you. And with the new year comes new openings. So we're sitting down with Kyle McClelland, the chef and culinary director of the legendary Boston restaurant Salty Girl, who just opened up a new outpost in West Hollywood right here in Los Angeles. We talk about their legendary tin fish collection, their sustainable approach to seafood, and how they adapted their approach to their new West Side locale. And then we head into the archives for a classic performance from our good buddy, Fletcher C. Johnson, who recently launched his own podcast, Listening to Fletcher C. Johnson. I recommend the three-part complete history of Williamsburg. What a trip down memory lane. So happy New Year once again. Excited to be here with you on Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Kyle, welcome to Snacky Tunes. You know, as an ex-Bostonian myself, I would like to say I hope you've been enjoying the winter, but I know it's been an absolute torrential downpour this whole week. Well, at least it's not freezing rain.
Yeah, at least it's not freezing rain. I will say California's needed the rain, and most people said that I've seen more rain in the last 3 months than they've seen in a couple of years. So,
look, it's no negative 4 degrees trudging through Harvard Square, nothing but a hoodie with my hands in my pockets. Mm-hmm. But we'll take the rain. We'll take the rain. Welcome. You are the chef and culinary director over at Salty Girl, which is an institution in Boston. And, you know, I was recently back in Boston last February, and I'll admit it'd been 20 years since I'd mm-hmm. been to Boston, and the scene is so different.
Yeah.
And I was so surprised by the amount of good food. So for people who aren't familiar with, I'd say, like, the Boston and then even the adjacent, like, Somerville, mm-hmm. Harvard Square scene, how would you describe it? What do most people not understand about it?
I honestly, I've watched the Boston food scene grow, especially within the last, 6 years that I've been back in Boston. With the Seaport blowing up, that's like a whole new Boston, you know what I mean? That never existed before. You know, obviously Cambridge, I see Cambridge as like the Brooklyn of Boston, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. across the river, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? The food scene's always been really great there too, but you're starting to see a lot of, big chefs coming into Boston, you know what I mean? Chefs that were predominantly in New York or, you know what I mean, in other markets. So I'm glad to see the food scene in Boston, getting to where, it should be, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like Boston kind of gets passed over every here and there, when sure. it comes to the food. But I definitely think that it's come a long way. You know what I mean? It really has. And we're obviously very excited to be doing so well in Boston.
I was a college student there, and that meant I was pretty broke most of the time. And so a lot of the good meals I had were where my parents came to town. And so back then, this is like 2000s, it was mostly like, I don't know, legal seafood and things mm-hmm. like that, which is maybe mm-hmm. not, from what I can tell and looking back, maybe not the end all be all of a seafood restaurant. But, most people do think of Boston as a seafood restaurant, but you guys at Salty Girl have also tried to make sustainability be a part mm-hmm. of it, which is tougher to do when you have like a larger, even a local chain like Legal Seafood. Mm-hmm. How have you brought a different approach to seafood? How have you folded sustainability into that? Why does it even make a difference for you of where you get your oysters and your fish and things like that?
I think for us, when we started this concept, I think the concept was built on, well, first of all, the tin fish, right? The tin fish was something mm-hmm. very new for us. It was very new for me, even coming into it and thinking about when we were talking about this in the beginning, in my mind, I was like, how's this going to work? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I know Boston's an old seafood town, and then once going to Europe and seeing the tin scene there, it made so much more mm-hmm. sense to me. So number one, we wanted to, the concept was kind of based on this small restaurant in Barcelona called Quimity Quimit. And that's kind of where the tin fish came from. When it comes to the sustainability, many years on Nantucket, many years in Massachusetts, I love working with seafood. It's something that I really enjoy doing. And I feel like New England has some of the best seafood, not just in the country, but in the world, to be honest with you. For us, working close with some of these small producers of oysters and, I've noticed over the years, it seems like a lot of these oyster companies, a lot of them are being passed down to their children. And then you have a younger generation kind of taking over these companies, and they're looking at things differently. They're trying things differently. There's a guy in Rhode Island that he grows his oysters in salt ponds rather than, in the ocean. So you get this a very, very different salinity. It's very interesting. So, we try to use some of the small guys, I think it's important to kind of support some of these local guys and I think that they have amazing product. When it comes to some of our purveyors, I try to work with some of the best purveyors in Boston.
Yep.
We've always been about quality. I think that's what kind of sets us apart. You know, I mean, I'd rather have like really good quality fish. You know what I mean? I think it's super important. The lobster, you know what I mean? You know, it's come a long way. You know, I know lobster's been, you know, right now it's, I know it's a talk of how to make it sustainability. You know what I mean? With the main production, I'm starting to hear that people are starting to try to do some farmed lobsters. It's starting to happen. You know what I mean? But for us, you know, working with some of the local guys, you know, I try not only local, but we're also trying to do stuff with, you know, we get a lot of the Japanese fish in.
Sure.
You know, being here in Los Angeles, it's the same thing. You know, we are an East Coast brand. We want to bring an East Coast restaurant to LA, but I also want to, I really want to, you know, use what LA has to offer. You know what I mean? There's a lot of cool stuff happening out here in LA. A lot of, you know, like the joint seafood guys, the guys that are dry aging all this fish. Super interesting. Oh, yeah. You know, I've been telling all the guys on the East Coast, they got to get on that game. I think it's super cool. I think it's super interesting. Some of the product that they've been producing, it kind of just blows me away. So, you know what I mean? I really want to like kind of showcase, you know, be this East Coast restaurant, have this East Coast seafood, but I really want to kind of showcase what the West Coast has to offer. You know what I mean? The Pacific Ocean's here. And they have some great product here. Obviously the weather's much nicer here. But like we've been working with a lot of small producers. We work with this, Stephanie Seafood. She's great. She's great. You know what I mean? And the fact that you get to work so closely with these people, you know what I mean? She's literally diving for urchins for us. You know what I mean? She's harvesting all this product herself. What else? I'm trying to think, Transparent. Have you guys heard of them? Transparent. The shrimp that they're doing.
Oh yeah. Incredible shrimp. Yeah.
Great product. Another company local that, you know, we're working with. You know what I mean? I feel like this younger generation of people, you know, in this business are kind of changing the game a little, you know what I mean? You know,
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, you bring up a good point because, you know, you're working with this new generation, but you are in many ways this classic New England seafood shack. And you have an outpost in London and you have the new outpost in West Hollywood. But people still expect, you know, when you think Boston fish shack, you're like lobster roll, oysters, things like that. How do you evolve people's mentality of that? How do you evolve or, you know, what feedback have you seen with the customer, especially since you've been around in Boston for 7 years, I believe, right? And as you open in London, as you open in LA, plus this idea of sustainability, how do you evolve it together, especially when people come down and sit down there and like, oh, what do you mean you don't have this product? What do you mean you don't have this thing that I had, you know, in Maine 25 years ago?
Right. You know what I mean? Obviously here on the West Coast, it's a little bit more difficult, you know what I mean? Just getting some of the East Coast product, you know what I mean? I get product flown in, you know, 2 to 3 times a week. I think for like, you know, the Boston scene, I feel like, you know, we always try to approach it. You know what I mean? I grew up on the Cape, you know what I mean? I used to go to, you know, all these fish shacks and, you know, fried clams and, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, all the lobster rolls,
all the belly,
the chowder, you know what I mean? We have all the classics. And then what we like to do, I like to kind of make, you know, maybe a more modern take on something that was a little classic. And we kind of go around that route. And I feel like people, especially in Boston, you know, we have such a good following in Boston. People are at least for what when we had the old space, when everything was done in front of everyone, I really felt that like people were more opt to try more things because they're watching it being done in front of them. Right. You know what I mean? You know, here in LA, we kind of have the same type of vibe and as in London too, where we kind of have this counter seating. But I find that, you know, people's palates have changed. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, us, you know, we have all our classics and we stay true to a lot of the classics, But you know what I mean? I love to, you know, change and play with food. There's so much good product out here now, you know, especially here in LA, you know, all this, you know, spot prawns and, you know, the fresh Santa Barbara uni, none of this stuff that, you know, by the time it made it to the East Coast, you know what I mean? It wasn't the same. You know what I mean? Like, no, it was so hard. It was so hard getting live spot prawns on the East Coast, but now they come to me and they're just so lively. You know what I mean? All this, you know, the Dungeness crab, all that stuff that was just so expensive there is it's different. You know what I mean? I'm going to be honest with you too. Even here, you know, I'm selling way more East Coast oysters than I'm selling West Coast oysters. And I really thought it was going to be an opposite. You know,
maybe because, it's, you know, the rare, the fruit, right? Maybe it's a little bit of, grass is always greener.
Maybe, you know what I mean? You know, so, but it's good. Now I'm seeing kind of the other side here where, you know, I'm seeing some of these producers from Washington, from Oregon, you know, even Northern California, some of these oysters coming out from there are really good too. So, you know, for us, I'm just, you know, I always try to stay ahead of the game a little. I'm always trying to find new product. I like to change things a lot. You know what I mean? You know, that's kind of how we try to, you know, move forward with this. You know, I try to change things seasonally, obviously. And then we really try to focus on what's fresh in the market. You know what I mean? Like a lot of my purveyors will be like, hey chef, you know, like, we got this amazing, you know, black cod or sable fishing, or I think you should try these, you know, spiny lobsters, or, you know what I mean? So I think we try to, you know, we stay true to the classics, New England seafood things, but everything else, we try to, you know, have a new take on it. Like, we're doing a big caviar program here. A lot of little caviar dishes, and we're finding, you know, I'm trying to make it more approachable, maybe a little more lowbrow. You know what I mean? Caviar dip, little caviar sandwiches. We do these little caviar mini rolls. You know, so again, I'm trying to make it not so highbrow and make it a little more fun and a little more approachable. And I'm finding it's going really well here. Hopefully soon to be done in Boston as well. Awesome. Yeah, you know, go ahead.
No. I was going to say, I want to talk a little bit about opening up and being in West Hollywood versus being in Boston versus being in London.
Sure.
And I want to talk a little bit about the design of the space, because it is gorgeous. And I know you worked with Jessica Schuster to bring it to life. Mm-hmm. But at first, I want to take a quick musical break. We have a song from Sarah Jaffe from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, yeah. Ceiling at my body reeling, that's why I go hot and cold. Pull me close, my temperature rising. I say, give me your touch, yeah, yeah. You're getting warmer. Hot and cold, pull me close. One hit, one wonder, one hit, one wonder.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are chatting with Kyle McClelland, chef and culinary director of Salty Girl, which started in Boston 7 years ago, then opened in London, and now has an outpost in West Hollywood. And right before the break, you were talking about fun and revelry and bringing a little bit of that feeling to the restaurant. And I can't think of a better spot in LA than West Hollywood to bring that type of approach to dining to something as classic and sometimes, I don't want to say serious, but revered as like the Boston Oyster, you know, Lobster Royal House.
Yep.
How did you pick West Hollywood and, you know, how did you approach it? Because LA has not always been kind to outside restaurants or restaurant groups. What were some of the pratfalls that you tried to avoid? Were there lessons learned before going in?
I think that, you know, so this has been a long time coming project. You know, Kathy, the owner, both of her children are here in Los Angeles and have been here for quite some time. Kathy obviously spent a lot of time in Los Angeles before she got into the restaurant business when she was doing her film business. So she has a big, you know, this is partly home for her too. You know, this was a long time coming. We had already been looking at spaces before the pandemic, in West Hollywood. You know, the area we are in, like Sunset Plaza, it's just a great area, honestly.
Yeah.
On the strip. So again, we had been looking at spaces right before the pandemic. Obviously the pandemic happened and luckily things didn't. Literally, we were there signing the contract that week that everything closed, like literally. So it all worked out well for us. But we knew we wanted to be here. And you're right. We did hear that it's tough for outside brands coming into LA. You know, but for me, like I said, I wanted to embrace LA. You know what I mean? I didn't want to be this outsider coming in and saying, you know what, we're from the East Coast. We're going to be an East Coast restaurant and it is what it is. You know what I mean? For me is I wanted to, you know, find the people that are the local people. You know, I think it's really important, you know, being in tune with the farmers markets here is something that I don't get to do in Boston. You know what I mean? I don't get to go to the farming markets and put my hands and touch produce. And, you know what I mean? I think that was a big thing for us. You know what I mean? We wanted to embrace what Cali had to offer, not only on the produce side, but also on the seafood side. And then again, working with some of these staples, these companies here in Los Angeles that, you know, I think it was important, you know, like getting with Stephanie, she, you know, she only works with certain people, you know what I mean? So like, I wanted to, you know, I mean, she's a small producer and she does great at what she does. Same with the joint guys. Like, again, I think they're doing something innovative. They're doing something new. I think it's interesting. I feel like people might have a weird perception of this dry age fish, who's hanging fish for X amount of days. You know, how are you eating that raw? You know what I mean? And honestly, after I started to try it and play with some of their product, it blew my mind. You know, like he's really figured it out.
I mean, just look at history. Aging, curing, all that stuff. It's nothing new. It's just maybe fallen a little out of fashion.
Yeah. And honestly, it's so interesting. And then honestly, just working with some of these local companies, I think it's really important. Mm. You know, we don't serve a lot of meat, but you know, what we do use, you know what I mean? I want to work with some of these great guys. You know, we use Premier Meats. He's been, mm-hmm, the company's, mm-hmm, been here for almost 70 years. Same thing. The son has taken over the company for the father. And it's the same thing. He's a little bit younger and he's doing a lot of cool stuff. And so, you know, I think that was the most important thing was, you know, I wanted to spend the time to introduce myself to these people, meet these people, and start a relationship with these people. I think it's really important. And I feel like as long as, you know, we stay tuned with the LA scene, I think we'll do just fine. I think that we have a good following. I feel like a lot of the people here are very well traveled. Most of them have, mm-hmm, been to our restaurant, mm-hmm, in Boston. So I think that, you know, again, when I'm hearing feedback from people, people are so happy we're here because they know that quality is important to us. You know, they know, mm-hmm, that like we always, mm-hmm, you know, have the freshest oysters, you know, so that's really important to me. So, you know, coming here to LA, so far so good. You know what I mean? I'm glad, you know, especially opening the week of Christmas. It was a little tough, but it's all worked out.
I have to say, you know, especially knowing how Boston can sometimes empty out in some ways during the holiday season, especially these last few years, like people sort of stick around and want a good meal in LA during the Christmas time.
I was just saying, I'm finding that, you know, the January, February is where you're in Boston and it's cold are different here. It's the January and February are the award season and it's busy here. It's like opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. So, now, you also brought a really beautiful spot to life, which, let's be honest, helps today because so much of things are driven by social media and photography and Instagram, mm-hmm, things like that. And you worked with this great designer, Jessica Schuster. What did you want to bring from the original restaurant, the original concept? And then since you guys have been so thoughtful, or at least thinking about making a space feel like it's from LA, what elements did you want to fold in from that point of view?
We really wanted to bring back the original space. You know what I mean? The OG Salty Girl, the 28 seats, the counter, you know what I mean? Having that, you know, personal kind of like, you know, everyone was right there. Everyone could see us. You know, I used to break down fish in front of everyone. You know what I mean? We wanted to bring that back a little. We felt like when we had to move to the other space, we lost that part of it. And I think that was a big part of who we were. So we got the counter seating back. Oyster Bar is such a focal point, you know what I mean, in the new restaurant. You know, you walk through those French doors, it's the first thing that you see, as well as the tinned fish. So, you know, we wanted to kind of, you know, we got the pink neon signs back like we had in the original space. We wanted that feel, but we wanted to be a little more elegant. You know what I mean? Obviously, being here in Los Angeles and being here on Sunset Boulevard, and, you know, like, let's be real, you know, we sell seafood, you know, mm-hmm, seafood's not cheap, right? So we wanted it to be a little more elegant, you know what I mean? We really did, but we also wanted to hold true to who we are. And me and Kathy have always been about this kind of like highbrow, lowbrow, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You can get your caviar, but you can get your clam chowder. You can get your, you know, fried calamari, you know what I mean? That's how we've always played it. And we really wanted to kind of do that in this space. You know, we have this beautiful patio here, you know, with the weather being so nice, you know what I mean? It's something that we...
I mean, not this last week, but yeah.
Of course, you can look at the future.
Yeah. But, you know, it's so funny. The highbrow, lowbrow is probably how, if I had to sum up Boston, was how I would sum up the city. In a perfect way, with that mentality. But, you know, people want to feel comfortable and they want to be, especially in that part of town, nestled into some spot that feels elegant, but then also know that they can get good food that looks really good. And I know that you've also brought over the Tin Fish program with you to this spot, which, you know, especially, you know, in America, but in LA, the last year or two has seen such an explosion of this type of approach to food. How did you want to stand out with your own program? What's your curation look like? How are you setting yourself apart from the other places that are selling the same type of tin fish?
And so, you know what I mean? Like, you know, since the beginning, I feel like it has come a long way in the last 7 years. I can remember doing our tasting. I can remember doing our tasting when we first started opening Salty, and we tasted 150 different tins. You know what I mean? And now, there's so many new companies. There's a lot of like, you know, for example, the Guy Savoy, he's got his own brand and he's doing tins a little bit differently where he's char grilling them and then putting them in a tin. Phenomenal. He's doing different cuts of tuna, like tuna neck, tuna belly, the back loin. It's super interesting. So tins have evolved so much over the last 7 years. You know, for us, we're constantly trying new products. You know, we're always tasting product. We find the things that we like, because I feel like, you know, there's some things that you know, we have changed a lot of the tins, even in London too. There's so many things that I can get in the UK that I can't get here in the States. You know what I mean? So I'm already seeing UK brand tins that are really cool that we have only in the UK.
You can't ship. What's the rule there?
To be honest with you, anything coming from America to the UK is super taxed. It's so expensive.
Oh yeah, you're not slipping a couple of tins into your luggage. And,
we definitely did that. Yes, but you know, definitely the tin program is it's ever changing. There's so many new different brands and companies, Portugal, Spain. You know what I mean? France. Mm-hmm. You're starting to see. You know. Just being in the UK, I started to see some of these UK brands, which I've never seen before. So it's super interesting. But again, you're starting to see a lot of local people too. You know, I mean, we do some stuff with Fishwife. We actually did a co-branding with them. We actually have our own tin now, a Salty Girl tin. You know, some of the Washington State Oyster guys are just doing great programs. So like a lot of the local stuff as well. It's like I said, and people, you're starting to see so many different things. Like I got some tins the other day and they're actually hake cheeks, the cheeks of hake.
I love a good fish cheek. Me doing it myself is a pain in the ass, but if someone else wants to scrape and cure and salt and everything.
Yeah. Yes, please. So there's so many new products and you're seeing these companies, honestly, some of them are so beautiful. Like, if you open some of these tins, like these are handmade, you know, someone's putting individual cockles in these tins, you know what I mean? I think for us, you know, like I said, I'm always looking for new products. You know what I mean? Where, I work with, you know, who's a good source? You ever heard of this Rainbow Garden Tomato out of Pennsylvania? He's this guy. He used to be an ex-chef. His company's called Rainbow Garden Tomato. He has like a local, he grows tomatoes or obviously, right? But he also does a ginormous tinned fish program, like huge. And he is so knowledgeable and his name's Dan and he's great. He's a great person to talk to. He's a great person to kind of just check out, super knowledgeable. And he's the same thing. He fell in love with tins and he's trying to bring tins from all over the world into the States and introduce them to people. He's been a great guy just to, you know what I mean? He's more of a retail guy, not really a wholesale guy, but he's someone to kind of just get on the phone with and chat and kind of talk about tins. And that's been fun finding people that, you know, enjoy the same thing. You know what I mean?
Start a new podcast. It's called Talking Tins, and that's a extension of the Sauté Girl brand.
I found when we went to London and we opened up the London location, you know, when we started doing the tin program with just, you know, our staff, you know, tins in London were considered to be like very lowbrow, like people like, you know what I mean? It wasn't a thing for them.
Same here. I mean, you know, you go to Trader Joe's, it's like $1.50 for anchovies.
Yeah. And honestly, I feel like, you know, we did like a full tasting. We tasted all the tins on the menu with them. And honestly, it's doing really well. You know what I mean? But I think that's important. I think our staff has to be knowledgeable. You know, people need to taste these things and know what they are. You know what I mean? I think it's super important.
Amazing. So listen, I know you've only been open for a few weeks, but as you look to the future and your place in LA, what would you like to see? What do you hope to see? What do you hope to become even beyond, you know, this first wave of like opening and media cycle and things like that? When everything settles in,
you know, I would like to become a neighborhood restaurant. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's what we became in Boston. You know what I mean? We always joke about it in the beginning when we first opened Sauté Girl in that little tiny space. I can remember the first 4 or 5 months, no one would come in. You know what I mean? There was days where no one would come in that place. And I used to, every day I would freak out and be like, Kathy, what are we going to do? And then honestly, you know what I mean? Once people started to come and word of mouth, and then we became this neighborhood restaurant. You know, that's what I enjoyed. I enjoyed, you know, seeing all the locals. You know what I mean? I had great relationships with so many guests and customers. You know what I mean? That's what I want to be here. I want to be embraced by West Hollywood and Los Angeles. You know, I want to represent the Sauté Girl brand, you know, like we have in Boston, here in LA. I want to be embraced in LA just like we were embraced in Boston. You know what I mean? Like I want to become this local, you know, West Hollywood neighborhood restaurant, you know, where people know that they can come and get good food and, you know, just, you know, like I said, we had such a small staff and we were always very, you know, friendly with, you know what I mean? We had such a great, like, people that came. That's what I want. I just want us to have these two restaurants on both coasts and to represent the city that we're in to the best of our ability and hopefully be here for many years, to be honest with you. You know, I really do think that this is a good journey for us and looking forward to see how the whole London thing pans out as well. You know, very, very different out there.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, thank you so much for taking the time. If people want to check out Sauté Girl, where can they go? How can they follow along, make reservations, come visit, things like that?
Yep. Yeah. Obviously, we have our website with our three locations. Obviously, you can follow us on Instagram. And please, you know, this is a great time to come in. We're trying lots of new things and you know, we're looking forward to, you know, everyone coming through.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you.
Parker. Shout out for setting this up. We have a song from Canyon Counterpart from the archives and then a live performance from Fletcher C. Johnson from the archives here on Heritage Radio Network.
I saw.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. We got Fletcher C. Johnson and crew in house. Boys, you want to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm John Doherty. I play drums.
I'm Todd Martin. I play the bass.
And I'm Fletcher. You might remember Todd from the last time we did the show.
I do.
He was the paper cutout that we brought in.
Oh, yeah. Well represented. If anyone wants to go back and hit pause on this episode, it was episode 95, and it was almost like 4 years to the day.
It took us 4 years to do the new record. So
oh, okay.
That's about how that works out for us.
That is about how it works out. It was a post-Thanksgiving episode, which is what this will be as well. So welcome. How's your cooking been? You couldn't cook 4 years ago. Can you cook now?
No, I can't. I have less.
Cook less. That's what people were kind of, you know, that's the question they wanted us to ask for your follow-up.
Yeah. Putting me on a cooking show isn't the wisest thing.
You're on the music part, so it's the second
half. Okay.
So Lessons in Tenderness, new record.
Yes.
Really interesting. So 4 years. Take us through those 4 years. A lot of couch surfing, a lot of wandering. How did the record get started, or the process of it getting made?
It was me and John. John's the newbie because he's been in the band for about 2.5 years, but me and Tommy, who was the old drummer, we started working on Lesson in Tenderness, and Todd, I don't know, just a slow, I write songs, I can write about 7 minutes worth of music per year, that's what I've learned.
Well, I mean, your songs are only like 2.5 minutes anyway, so that's like three and a half songs.
Yeah, that's
a good ratio.
There's a lot of bad stuff that I write, but it's about 7 minutes of quality music
per year. It's not
seven
continuous minutes.
It's not say yeah. There's bad breaks, and then.
So you ended up. You took a tour to Texas and California. You ended up living in a practice space in Orange County. What was the name of the practice space, and what was it like living in there?
Well, I would just went. So we were on Burger Records. Did Salutations, and Burger Records did Lesson in Tenderness. Who are good friends of ours and my favorite label.
Amazing label.
And I went to Burger Records, having never been in the store. It's a record label and a storefront. So I went out there figuring out, I just decided I was going to live with them for a while. I liked them. I hadn't physically met them, but I talked to them on the phone. They'd done a record and I really liked everything they were doing. So I went out there to live with them, but I learned that they lived in the store. Like, they didn't even have apartments themselves. So
do they have bedrooms?
They don't. No. One of the guys mostly sleeps in the back room of the store, and the other guy sleeps in a van that they own in the parking lot behind the store.
I remember when Darren and I, our first apartment, if you want to call it, it was essentially a room in New York, and there was one odd, just random piece of drywall that was in a corner. And so Darren shoved a mattress in there, and I just slept in the living room, and that was fine.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, that was fine. So
you were doing better than Sean and Lee are doing from Burger Records.
I mean, is it now just like a point of pride? I mean, I feel like Burgers should be doing well enough that they could get at least
sink all the money back into putting. They right about the time I think they could get a nice apartment. There's another record they hear and they want to put that out too,
or another festival.
Yeah.
So where did you live if they were living in the back of the store in a van? Where did you?
Well, we know from New York City about having rental practice spaces, which isn't as necessary in Los Angeles because people have basements and things there that we don't have where you can make a lot of noise. But I remember sitting on the couch. I had a book that I pulled off the rack. I was slowly realizing that staying with the Burger Records guys was not going to work out for me. And
did the van have a back seat?
What?
Did the van have a back seat?
We had a, yeah, well, yeah, Lee's sleeping in the van, so he had a back seat, but I don't, you don't want to share a van. I had my own van.
Okay.
I just looked into practice spaces because we were finished. There's a member of the band, Adam Meisterhans, who plays on the Less Than Tenderness record, who was from West Virginia. He's living in Nashville now as a studio musician. He's really excellent player. And he had done the tour, and I wanted to get him on the record because he knew all the songs. So it was also about the cheapest way to live and get Adam Meisterhans to play guitar on the record. So I just looked up practice spaces in the Orange County area, which is where Burger Records is, and ended up living in that practice space for about 2 months.
Did anybody say anything? Did they know, or were you just very careful?
No, they really didn't care. I almost lucked out because the practice space was going under. They had just lost the lease. So when I asked if I could live there, they said you can, or not live there. If I asked if I could have a space, they said, well, we only have it for 2 more months. But the thing about that was there's a lot of bands that have been there for years, and they didn't like the fact that they were getting kicked out. So there was rowdy parties in there almost every night. I mostly actually slept in my van outside of the practice space and then would work and hang in there all day. But it was...
And you talked about recording the record, recording the instruments during the day, and then recording the vocals at night. What made you split up the process?
Necessity, because it was so loud. I mean, even the night was like really late night. It would be when all the partying was done, when everyone went to bed. I would hang at Burger Records in the back room and watch TV and stuff till like 4 in the morning, and then go back over to the practice space and see if someone was still making noise, and then record all the quiet stuff, do the tambourines and things like that.
Can we hear a song?
Absolutely.
What are you going to play first?
What should we play first? Yeah. This is the last song on the Less Than Tenderness record, and a song that we've never played acoustically before. It involves a lot of rocking, so we'll see what we can do.
Time, working out ways to get by all.
After living in the van, you moved to LA to keep to mix the record, right?
There's a point. I mean, in the practice space, there wasn't a shower or anything. There's a bathroom. I had pretty good athlete's foot going on, so I was washing my feet in the sink a lot and I remember going and playing a show, like an acoustic show at a college that they invited me to do, and just like begging to go into the dorms and use the shower. So actually,
how much begging? Like, please? Or just like, hey, just a casual, can I just check out the showers?
It was more like, I just kept hanging out with them. like I was like, all right, we're good here. And then they were talking about like a senior art show. And I was like, cool, man. What's going on with that? Like, I loved senior art shows. Let's check that out. And then like just kept hanging till I was eventually back in their room.
And how was the shower?
It's amazing.
So from there, watching and sleeping in the van in the practice space.
Well, I went up to LA. I have friends up there as well. We got our mutual friend, Taylor Cohen.
TC.
Filmmaker, director.
Lover.
Well, I crashed with him for a while, which meant he was already crashing on someone's couch. So I started crashing behind the couch that he was already crashing on. So that was a pretty good run there. They had a lot of guys in that house, so you know you can squeeze in.
Yeah, no one's gonna notice.
One more guy behind the couch with the guy crashing on the couch is going to work. But eventually, a buddy of mine went on tour, and I got to take his room. A dude I played in a band with, Kyle Thomas, let me take his bedroom for a while, so that's where I did a lot of the...
Yeah, I saw that great photo of you, Matt, and him from like your first tour together back in the day.
Yeah.
So being at his house, you also had access to some of his gear and equipment.
He didn't have a lot of stuff at the time. He had a beautiful backyard with a palm tree that was an umbrella that blocked all the sun out, and it was the true Los Angeles experience. He had some quality weirdo roommates who I like a lot, and a blind cat, which I didn't realize was blind the whole time I lived there. It wasn't until I was just always doing stuff with cats. Are great. They don't need eyesight, I learned. We watched the season finale or the series finale of The Office together, and the cat got it, and it couldn't even see.
Sorry. So did all of these kind of rotating influences and settings help shape the sound of the record or influence you, or all the kind of downtime that you had of just kind of hanging out allow you to evolve your sound from the previous release?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, like I said, it was 4 years between releases. There's a lot of evolving sounds already. Just trying... Being out there was good because there's a lot of bands from Los Angeles that I like a lot, so being surrounded by contemporary musicians who are doing stuff that I'm into is cool. I think some of the earlier records were more influenced by 60s and 70s bands, and just I was catching up with what was going on right now.
Who were some of the bands that influenced the sound on this record?
A lot of the contemporary folk bands, a lot of the burger bands, I'd say. I was hanging with the guys in the Memories, and I like their tunes. We did a tour when we were doing the West Coast. We were on tour with Natural Child, who I'm a huge fan of. So all of their sounds have come in. It's other people are influenced by those earlier bands, but they're doing their own thing, taking it in their own direction. I want to do that. I want to stay contemporary, but also love the music that I've always loved.
Yeah, and what sounds did you layer in? Because, I mean, in the last time you were here, you talked a lot about the Beatles and the perfect soundwriting and the 60s and 70s influence. What actual noises or sonic soundscapes have you added on top of the music that you already love and make?
Well, I was trying to... The hardest thing is when you don't play keyboards and trying to get some tasteful synths, I think. There's a lot of untasteful synthesizing going on these days, so you need to find just the right tones that make sense with what you're doing. I think when you're trying to incorporate it into live instruments or acoustic instruments, there are certain sounds that clash, and there's certain sounds that work perfectly together. And there's other sounds that clash perfectly. So,
create another song.
Absolutely.
What are you gonna play?
Do always. One, two, three, four. Can't seem to leave on time.
One of the greatest things to come out of the new record is the Water Than Me video. How long did that take? Well, just to, for people who have not seen it, it's you essentially just moving your hips, walking down the street in multiple locations, in multiple clothing outfits and changes. How long did it take for that to be filmed? All right, and how did you film it?
Me and Johnny D, the drummer of the band, shot it in 2 days. It's an idea I had forever, and I kept throwing it out there for talking to you, Taylor Cohen, to many director friends, and they were like, well, okay, that's a good idea, well, but what about this idea? And I said, this is simple. I think we can do it. And John said, I got a better idea. And then we talked about that idea, and then I convinced him to still do this idea, and I thought it.
What was the idea that lost?
We got...
Well, a slow motion video of you going to be on a hoverboard and everybody kind of throwing things at you.
John has, this still might come out. So okay. It's a slow, he wants me to get broken up with and then walk outside of my apartment, get on a hoverboard and then go down the street while rows of people on either side of the street throw food at me.
I'd watch that for 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Actually for the last song that we just song we just played. It's
perfect. Oh, that's perfect.
It's just us. Basically, he just wants to strap something onto the bed of his truck that he thinks he can nail the video in one try.
And throw us up a Fletcher.
Yeah. Just get it out there.
If that thing you strap on in the back of your truck is not aligned just perfectly, that's a lot of food that's going to waste.
Yeah, so. That's true. But you could do a test run, like pantomiming the food being thrown. Yeah.
This is why we come on podcasts, because to get those different food ideas.
Yeah, there you go. Not a food guy. But for the video, I mean, it looks like it's actually shot over the course of a year just from all the outfit changes, 2 days. And
I brought two gigantic Rolly suitcases of outfits. And there's a point where I'm going up an escalator. Now,
and there's a suitcase there.
There's a suitcase. That's one of the suitcases. Now, what you can learn from is that Forever 21 doesn't care what you do on their escalator. Because we tried to nail it, so we were crossing at the same time. We probably did it 4 or 5 times, right?
We were in there for, like, at least 25 minutes.
Yeah, we were 25 minutes. Not one employee questioned what we were doing when we were, like signaling to each other on the escalators to say when we were going to get on. And also, if you look at it, there's a woman dancing on the escalator that John's on with a camera, and that was completely unplanned, but it's the greatest part of the whole video.
It's really good. I did actually wonder what that suitcase was on the video, because it's just so weird.
It's one of the two suitcases I had that was full of outfit changes.
And did I see that your wedding made it into the video as well?
My actual wedding, yeah. My brother also helped shoot it as well, did some good work, but probably the best thing he did was... He was, he was my only groomsman.
He's best man.
The best man.
The groomsman, the best. I mean, he's got a lot of hats.
When you go to City Hall, I don't know, you need a guy.
Yeah, you need one guy.
He's my guy.
He's a witness.
And he said, I know this is your wedding, but you're going to really want this shot. And so he made me do my hip wiggle dance at the chapel.
I mean, City Hall. Your wife looked like she was a good sport.
She looked grumpy, but that was even better.
Yeah, yeah.
She is a good sport.
She is a good sport. Well, I want to make sure we have time for one more song. Thanks for coming on the show again. Hopefully, it won't be 4 years for the next time. Where can people
get? We just got out of recording studio doing a new EP.
Oh,
last week.
Oh, perfect. So, where can people find the record? Find you, see your shows, offer you a place to shower, etc.
We're on all the music sources if you want to listen to the tunes, and we don't have anything coming up. We're going right into the holiday season here. So. Yeah.
By the way, when
we play around New York a lot, and Bryce just asked us to go play this festival he set up in Atlanta, so we'll be hopefully down there in March.
Cool.
As well as doing a little bit of touring down there, and we play around the New York area a lot.
Where we last left you, final question. You were working on your Twitter game. Anything to update 4 years later?
I mean, I get one good one like every 4 months.
That's on par with your music writing.
Yes, you're right. That's
okay, cool.
Like, that's my entire artistic style.
I'm sensing a pattern here. Well, big thank you to Gorilla Tacos. And if you haven't done it yet, we are nominated for Taste Awards for Best Radio Show and Best Podcast. If you go to bit.do/stvote, that's bit.do/stvote. We'd really appreciate if you voted for us. Vote twice, podcast and radio.
Vote for Snacky Tunes.
Thanks. Thanks for coming on. Hope you have a good Thanksgiving. What are you going to take us out with?
This is a song about, I work night shifts. I live the nightlife still. And my wife, she works days, so this is a song about her letting me sleep because she always trying to wake me up in the morning, and that's rude.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.